welcome to Drawing Blood, our podcast about visual culture, history of science and medicine, and the macabre. I'm Emma Merkling.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And today we're going to be talking about the myth of Cosmas and Damian, and a few representations of it, mostly from the 15th century in Italy and Spain. And some sort of related things that come up around race, around surgery.
Yeah, and to that end, our content warning for this episode includes some things that we've talked about before, such as racialized language and discussions and depictions of surgery, blood, and cutting into bodies. But we also want to give you a heads up that there will be some particularly triggering mentions of the brutal treatment of Black people, especially women, by white medical practitioners. That'll be when we start to relate these 15th century images to later centuries.
We're very much, neither of us are medievalists or Renaissance art historians. So I feel like anything we talk about is very much going to be coming from, I think there's still interesting stuff to say, like from our perspective as sort of...
No, definitely. You know. But the reason I'm bringing this up, or I'm bringing this to do as an episode is because, you know, it relates to the history of surgery, which is something that I'm really interested in, and we'll talk about it later, but... this story gets mentioned a lot in contemporary surgical histories. So I wanted to kind of do a deep dive into it and be like, what is going on? What is this? And why are there so many paintings of it? Let's start with the first image. Emma, here it is. Let's zoom in.
This is so cool. I love, like, my first thought, and I know this is anachronistic because... I happen to know from the caption I can see that this is from the 15th century. It is, right?
Yeah, 1495.
Okay. So I know this is anachronistic, but the first thing I think of is Hans Holbein's Ambassadors, right? That really famous painting at the National Gallery, partly because both of them have this sort of magnificent, sumptuous green backdrop, even with that black gap at the side where in the Holbein there's like a crucifix peeking out.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And, you know, these two figures sort of both in very Renaissance-y clothing, wearing those sort of
I wonder how many times we're going to say Renaissance-y as a very precise descriptor of two modernists.
We're going to lose all of our listeners who focus on Renaissance and medieval art. And you know what? We accept that. Yeah, that is fine. You know, we can move on. We can move past it. So there's two figures, the two main figures, that I mentioned, who are wearing these sort of red caps. They have halos around them, so I'm assuming that they are saints. One of them also has the sort of hand up in a benediction pose.
Yeah.
So yeah, the most arresting part of this picture is this body that is in the center of the composition. It is on this, I mean, I want to say an operating table body because I know the themes of this episode, but also because it's got that feel, right? It has a sort of like crisp white blanket draped over the edges, and they are this figure who's lying in the bed, is missing the lower half of his left leg below the knee. And one of the two figures in the red caps who I mentioned is attaching another leg, is about to attach another leg to this leg. And it's really hard to miss the fact that the man lying in the bed is white and the leg that is about to be attached is black. And beneath, there are these two sort of angelic figures, and they're holding the other leg, which is a white leg and looks quite diseased. Like it has these, what would you, like lesions?
Yeah, lesions, striations, yeah.
So that's clearly just been amputated, I would imagine. To me, it's an early surgery scene. I mean, I don't know if it actually is, but like that would be my guess, which is fascinating because I don't know anything about pre-Enlightenment medicine.
Yeah, it's a super interesting scene. And I like what you said about it being an operating table because, you know, it's got all these lovely cloths on it, so you would assume, and pillows with all these lovely tasseled details, so you'd think, oh, it's a bed. But then there's this hard line all the way around it that makes it feel like a slab, like a mortuary slab almost.
It's giving mortuary slab. Yeah. It's giving operating table.
And I think it's important to say that when you first, or at least for me, when I first look at this image, the incongruous detail and the thing that my eye immediately goes to are those two disembodied legs, the white one and the black one. Like, yes, the two figures who are attaching the leg to the patient, if we can call him that. Yes, those two figures are like very much the emphasis of the work, and they're in these sumptuous garments and these red caps and these halos. But I think it's the legs that your eye gets drawn to.
Definitely. And part of the reason is visually because of that white amputated leg that's being held up, which is this perfect L shape, yeah. and guides the eye directly to the lesion, the space between the amputated leg and the leg that's about to be reattached. What was like the Lego for girls that you never wanted to get, but that people always gave you because you were a girl?
Oh God, I'm
Playmobil?
Thinking, yeah. Okay, to be fair, I had a Playmobil medieval castle and it was the best thing of my entire life.
Okay, I always wanted Lego.
No, it looks like something like magnetic that's going to attach. Like, it doesn't look like they're actually going to do any intense suturing. Like,
no,
we know.
There's no tools, I would say.
There's a single gold box. There's not any blood. I wanted to actually say what you were saying about the L shape of mm-hmm. the white leg that's being held by the angel. I actually hadn't really thought about it before, but that is such an unnatural shape for a leg
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, the foot is flexed.
The foot is flexed, which of course, like if it is a dead, diseased leg, which you think it would be because you're thinking that it's coming off of the sick man on this bed, yeah. it's just so 90 degree angle, which it mirrors the candle that the other angel is holding. So it feels inhuman.
And the thing I want to add, and this makes the whole bean reference not wasted, is that there is something about, okay, now I don't want to say enlightenment, but about knowledge going on here. You know, the lit candle that's sort of like guiding the way.
Yeah.
And the way the angels are both almost the what do you call people who help in a surgery?
Orderlies, nurses.
Yeah, they're like the orderlies, mm-hmm. you know, who are guiding the leg and also pulling apart this curtain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she is holding it. They are holding it with their hand, yeah.
There's the sense of revelation, right? That's the halos, really that the angels are there, yeah.
But I think it's this really interesting confluence of scientific and medical revelation with religious revelation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's not really any distinction.
No, there's
made,
not.
At least visually.
No. But I think it's just such a beautiful and strange painting.
Yeah. I'm guessing that the two figures are Cosmas and Damien, unless, okay, yeah. And I mean, I know we're talking about a miracle. So I imagine the miracle is the sort, whatever the surgical intervention, or let's not call it surgical at this stage, maybe, whatever the intervention is that's happening, I imagine is the miraculous thing based on the halos, based on the sort of benediction. So is this what they're known for?
Yes. So Cosmas and Damien were these saints who gained a lot of prestige like after the 9th century. And that's because the 9th century is the first time that this miracle, known as the miracle of the black leg, so,
yeah.
I mean, you could have probably could
what
have
was
guessed that.
Evident.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
When that first entered into the hagiography or, you know, the written study of saints. But they were around in the 3rd and 4th century AD. So they were twin brothers. Or they were twin brothers who ended up being saints who were also physicians. So they were religious and medical.
They were physicians in life. Not,
well.
Oh, I mean, that's the story,
yes, that's
right?
the story, okay, okay. is that they were physicians in life. And so they were early Christian martyrs. And so they were martyred probably in 303 AD under the reign of Diocletian. And we can get into their death later. But there are a lot of images of them from mostly like the 15th century. And this particular painting is from Spain, but a lot of them are in Italy. And that's why I first cottoned on to Cosmas and Damien as these really interesting figures. You know, I was doing my classic American study abroad thing, taking like the best art history course of my life in Florence. And there were these creepy medical twins everywhere around Florence. And I was like, what is the deal yeah. here? But of course, like the Medici, which means doctors, you know, they were the big boss family in Florence during the Renaissance period. And so they used Cosmas and Damien a lot in their iconography and their visual representations. So that's how I first really became interested in these guys. So there are a lot of images of them in Florence.
And are they, in the ones that you saw, is the blackness of the leg always sort of a feature?
So that's the thing is, I guess the images that I was used to seeing, that I first saw, didn't depict this miracle outright. It was more like, you know, the types of images that are a saint with their attribute. Like
okay.
Catherine with her wheel, Lucy yeah. with her eyeballs, that kind
that
of thing.
That one dude with his flayed skin.
Exactly. That one. So it'd be them with like medical instruments. You can see this guy with, I think it's an apothecary's box. That's that gold box in the middle. But so you see that quite often. Or you often see them with like a uroscopy flask, which is what you
what
put the
that?
Pee in. Which is fun.
Love that for them.
I don't know if you ever see the actual pee, but So these twins were born in kind of modern day Turkey / northern Syria, which I think makes their representation as like very pasty white as really interesting. You know, we see that in a lot of religious imagery from this. You know, Jesus was not
white.
Yeah. So, it kind of rolls in with those kinds of tropes. And during their life and after death, they did healings. And this is actually one that happened after death. And
after their death.
So after it's like their death.
Posthumous miracle.
A posthumous miracle. And so I learned a new word, and that is incubation, which I know is a word that means other things. And so I did know those definitions before. But so the idea of incubation goes back to a Greek myth of Asclepius, which is Apollo's son. And it was this idea that this like Greek god, if you fell asleep like in his temple or after sacrificing something to him, then he would come and heal you, or he would tell you to do something that would then heal you in your sleep. And so this painting is called A Verger's Dream, or that's like the first part of the painting's title. And so the verger, he's like basically a deacon or like a church caretaker.
Okay.
But he fell asleep in a church of Cosmas and Damian, and he dreamt of the saints repairing his diseased leg, which is the one that we see in the foreground of this painting. It's really impossible to know, like, of course, it's a myth, so it's impossible to know a lot of things, but what exactly kind of disease this was. Yeah. Like, some people say cancerous, some people say gangrene.
Doesn't feel really, like cancer is such a ubiquitous, you know, term for like everything.
I know. Yeah. And the definition of cancer has mutated and changed in lots of, or throughout the centuries. So it's really hard to pin that down. But once again, does it really matter? Probably not. So basically, this man fell asleep. He dreamt that these surgeon saints came and fixed him. They took away his festering, gangrenous, possibly cancerous leg, and they replaced it with the healthy leg of a very recently deceased, as in he'd been buried that day, Ethiopian man, who had been buried in the same church.
So maybe we're going to get to this, but does the Ethiopian man get the white leg?
Yeah, he does. So they transplant. Okay,
that's interesting.
The diseased leg onto the dead black body, and they transplant the healthy dead leg, but now has been given new life, onto the alive white body.
Why am I thinking of cyborgs? Maybe it's because of that, the way that they're almost like Lego pieces, like you said, like magnetic.
Yeah, there is something.
That angle.
Yeah, there is something very like inhuman cyborgy about this action. And once again, I think it is because, you know, to modern eyes, it doesn't look, it's not as messy as a transplant would be. You know what I mean? It's too clean and it's too bright. Yeah. And yeah. But so this, as I said, this legend, the miracle of the black leg, first came around in the 9th century. So, you know, 500, 600 years after they were around. The most famous relating of this legend came from an Italian monk named Jacobus de Voragine. Butchered that, but that's roughly what it sounds like.
He's like, not going to care. I can assure you.
But it's the very American way of Voragine. You know what I mean? Like, that's just
Vanderbilt.
He's disgusting. And he wrote The Golden Legend around 1275. So it's all of these different stories about different saints, right?
And that's where we get the story, the main story of Cosmas and Damian.
Yeah, the this miracle. Of them, the miracle of Black Leg. So I'm just going to go. It's a quite short little snippet, so I am just going to read it aloud. Okay, so once again, this is 1275. And Jacobus writes, Pope Felix, who was an ancestor of St. Gregory, erected a noble church in Rome in honor of Saints Cosmas and Damian. In this church, a man whose leg was consumed by cancer devoted himself to the service of the holy martyrs, so Cosmas and Damian. And one night as he slept, the saints appeared to him, bringing salves and instruments, and one said to the other, "Where shall we find new flesh to replace the rotted flesh which we are to cut away?" The other replied, "This day an Ethiope was buried in the cemetery of St. Peter in chains. Do thou fetch his leg, and we shall put it in place of the sick one." Thereupon he hastened to the cemetery and brought back the Moor's leg, and that's M-O-O-R. And they cut off the leg of the sick man and put the other in its stead. Then they anointed the leg which they had cut off and attached it to the body of the dead Moor. So they did swap them. When the man awoke and felt no pain, he put his hand to the leg and discovered that the wound was no longer there. Wondering whether he was himself or another, he held a candle to the leg and still found no ill in it. Then, overjoyed, he leapt from his bed and narrated to all what he had seen in his dream and the manner of his curing. Speedily, therefore, they sent to the Moor's tomb and found his leg cut off and the sick man's leg laid in the tomb beside the Moor.
Laid in the tomb beside the Moor, actually. See, so it's interesting. Like, it's not necessarily reattached.
Yeah, or according...
Yeah, to the legend.
To the written legend, yeah.
But actually, the thing that sticks out to me the most... That's super interesting. The thing that sticks out to me the most... There's a few things. One is Black, Moor, and Ethiopian,
mm-hmm.
which shows to me a certain sort of... There's racialized language, you know, I don't know.
Three different forms of racialized language.
You know, that like Ethiopian being, as I understand it, the term just in general for people sort of of sub-Saharan Africa who I think are Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Moor, we all know from sort of like Othello and Shakespeare this sort of broader term for blackness, and then the miracle of the black leg. But actually, the thing that's most interesting to me is this idea of, what did you say? Seeing no ill?
Yes.
In it?
He found no ill in it. Held it's a candle, like the candle in this painting.
Held a candle. Which also evokes all those like biblical stories and sort of ideas about revelation and like see it truth and enlightenment, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
The knowledge.
Let there be light, enlightenment.
Yeah, blah, blah. And I think the thing that stands out for me is sees no ill in it can have so many meanings. Yeah. But it's not saying he doesn't see difference.
Yeah, because if you're thinking about the word ill meaning disease, then...
Yes, well, he's not good. But even saw nothing wrong with the fact that he got a black leg, didn't notice that he got a black leg.
Yeah,
you know?
It's really interesting. I think there's a lot of ambiguity in this written account.
Okay, so I have a question about race in this period in general, because I'm very aware, you know, as a person who focuses a lot on the 19th century, and we've talked about scientific racism that emerges in the 19th century in other episodes and how much that continues to inform... Mm-hmm. how race is lived and understood by us sort of in the 20th, 21st century, which
absolutely.
Of course is very, you know, very related to industrialization and the transatlantic slave trade and all of other stuff. This is a lot earlier. And I'm curious, I mean, I know that there's this argument, I've heard it before, that because these notions of race as we understand them today sort of emerge in the 18th or 19th centuries, or at least that's the argument, that it's not relevant to discussing, or maybe not historically accurate or something to discussing this past art. But I mean, even just looking at this picture, perhaps that's true in like a purely semantic sense. Like I get that almost certainly race didn't mean the same thing.
Well, yeah, it's
then,
just,
and that it wasn't lived the same
like
way.
Like I was talking about the definition of cancer was different then. The definition of race would have been different then as well. Yeah.
But things about alterity, identity, and skin color seem quite evidently a part of at least this image for
and
me
I,
even. Do you know what I mean?
And I think it's not only... I think the fact that they're cutting into a body, it makes you think of not only external but also internal difference in this image. Like it does kind of... The fact that they're cutting into the body makes you think of not
beyond
only...
Skin.
Beyond skin. Mm. Like it's not only... The difference isn't only skin deep, or like maybe it is, but it's bringing up that question by showing the cross-section of these two legs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's bringing up those questions at least, even if they're not answering it or if we can't have like a definitive answer to it.
And did you mention this is in Spain?
This is in Spain.
Okay, so I vaguely remember from Olivette Otele's book, what's it called, African Europeans. She talks that, which is kind of a sweeping narrative from classical antiquity, I think to the present, about African Europeans
mm-hmm.
and about black people in Europe. I do remember her talking a bit, and I know from having grown up in South Africa and some of that history too, about sort of the Portuguese, that there is a slave trade going on at this time. I don't know if that necessarily means that that's how black people are viewed, but I do remember her talking about there being black slaves and black servants at this time.
I mean, this and, you know, her book and a lot of excellent scholarship around this period.
Geraldine
and,
Heng also writing.
Yeah, and you know, it just kind of flies in the face of every medieval... or Renaissance movie we've ever seen, you know, where like every single person is white. No one has ever seen a black person. If you're, you know, living in the 15th century, it's very much not the case.
Sidebar, this narrative, this idea that I feel like we all have, you know, from a lot of pop culture, a lot of also how it taught the Renaissance, the Middle Ages. I mean, all art, actually.
Yep.
That black people somehow like didn't exist in Europe until a certain... Like, this is the thing that's so great about Otele's book. But anyway... You know, as if they, like, didn't exist in Europe at all, even if they were obviously a minority. It reminds me of one of the more shocking things that I ever witnessed in a museum, which was I was in the Petit Palais in Paris mm-hmm. in, like, 2018, and there was an exhibition of Miró paintings. They had this show, and he has this enormous painting called, oh, God, what's it called? something like the sleeping black woman with an exposed breast, or something like that. And there was this school group, and it was like a white woman, I think, presumably belonging to the museum in some capacity, who was maybe in her 40s, maybe 50s. And then this bunch of black teens from Paris, ranging, I would say, from like 13 to maybe like 16. And they all run in, they're like, oh my God, Miro was a racist. Because it's one of the paintings also where that sentence is written big across the canvas. Mm-hmm. And it has the word, I believe it's not noir, I believe it's negro, the you know, negress, something like that. And then I proceed to hear this woman explain how, no, actually, Miro wasn't racist because there were no black people in Paris at this time except for Josephine Baker. What? And I was just like, what? And sorry, I'm just like, this is a complete sidebar now, but it's like, it was one of the most explicit moments of like direct erasure.
No,
of
these that's kids exactly experience. The word.
Because they're like, they come in and they say, they're black kids who live in Paris. And they're like, oh my God, look, this is racist. And they see something of their experience, something of what they know reflected in this image. And instead of doing what you should do as an art historian, just being like, yes, let's explore that. That's interesting. Why do you say that? What are you seeing? What makes you say that? Being like, the only black person in Paris was Josephine Baker.
But see, but that's so common in like not only art historical, you know, stories of like pre-modern centuries, right? Or even modern centuries, even 19th, early 20th century, saying like there are no black people around or there are no black people in these fields or whatever. But like also, you know, that curator or whoever she was has probably been fed that not only from whatever art historical background she has, but also through pop culture, because that is...
Yeah, but also like grow up. Like,
No, exactly. Like do some...
Basic.
Yes, some expansion.
Anyway, the reason I sort of brought that up, or what's interesting about this, is just to say that like, obviously we know that race isn't a static category that doesn't change over time, but even the story itself asks us to attend to things like, you know, nationality, which is associated with different skin colors, different races, different experiences, and then this very evident visual culture of this black leg. And I was just tying that into, like I said, that chapter in the Otello book that I read that mentioned the presence of slaves. Even Chris, you know, one of them was, I remember her telling a story about a young black girl slave who was baptized, meaning Christian. The black body in this case is also Christian, right? And that's
No, definitely. There's a big overlap between race and religion in this story. And I actually, so I want to go back and show you a couple other images that I think might help us think through this presence of
the black
non-white bodies, leg, of the black body, of the black leg, perhaps in a more explicit way than this particular painting does. Because I wanted to start with this because it is just the lower leg that's shown. Yeah.
It's also interesting that it's a brown, I say black, because I mean the race, but it's a brown leg that's shown.
Versus...
Wow, okay. Wow, literally in the next image. This looks like... Was it a Balenciaga? Do you know, like, the, like, thigh-high, like, black sock
It looks
boot?
Like the, like, from Devil Wears Prada. Oh my God, are you wearing the thigh-high...
Well, exactly.
Whatever boots they are. Yeah. So the black leg is literally a thigh-high Balenciaga sock boot.
So in this case, which is... I can see from the title of this Wikipedia link you've put up, Fra Angelico. So now we're in Florence, I presume, in the 15th century. And the actually quite like gender ambiguous now figure resting on what is much more evidently a bed. We can see sort of the headboard.
Still looks really hard though.
Still, like, still looks like something you don't want to have an up on. And in this case, the two figures are depicted, to my mind, much more like involved surgeons in a way. You know, they're bending over the body, they're touching the leg, they're fixing it. But in another sense, there's no blood here. There's this miraculous join, which I'm sure is the point. And the leg is literally black, like the color black.
Yeah.
Possibly a dark, I mean, who knows?
Like it could
just
void.
Be a reproduction. But it's, yeah, it's like also a void in the middle, in the center of the painting that contrasts, you notice it even more because it contrasts so strongly with the gold of their halos, the white of the sheets, the red.
And once again, they are in matching outfits, which they are, you know, they're always shown up as wonderfully fashionable twins together.
Oh, and in this case, is that like sort of cloud?
That's what I was about to say. Okay. Yeah, I hadn't noticed this before, but like
one they're emerging.
Their otherworldly
nature?
Spiritual nature is coming through in this image more. It looks like they're coming out of the clouds. And once again, you know, remember that this is a dream, right? So it has that, I mean, everything looks so solid in this room. You know, Fra Angelico's got his 90-degree angles, his linear perspective. you know, it's all very like solid and real. And then you've got at the bottom of the physician's outfits of Cosmos and Damien's robes.
Just the suggestion.
Yeah.
Of something else.
Which is nice. But I think that once again, your eye in this image, even though you've got the bright white halos, the clouds, the, you know, very like geometric room with the one with the perspective, the eye goes to the blackness of that leg.
Although I would say that if you hadn't told me what the story was about, I would think they're like undressing a woman in bed.
Mm.
Like pulling stockings down or well,
because once again, it doesn't feel surgical.
No, yeah. Especially in this case.
Yeah. So that's one depiction of the black
leg. And when's it from?
This one is between 1438 and 1440. Okay. And so, you know, this was after they've put the black leg back on
right. The
person. And then there's this one. So you start at this one and you immediately just see the twins in their matching outfits, holding their books, looking fabulous.
They're huge. This one's a different format. So it's more like an altarpiece type shape. And at the bottom, there's two little scenes.
And this is by Matteo de Pacino, or the Master of the Renucci Chapel. And it's a little bit earlier. So this is like circa 1370. But if you zoom in, that's when you get to see the miracle of the black leg. So yes, we love Cosmos and Damien.
And the predella.
But way less interesting to just see the two of them versus...
Wow. Okay.
The image of the black leg, yeah. Which is in the bottom left side of the predella, which is the bottom part of the altarpiece.
So this one's fascinating. Okay, so we have a much more peopled scene, like a much busier scene. Everyone looks like Dante. They're wearing like little red hats and little red coats. Uh-huh. There's a figure lying in what is once again much more obviously a bed.
And he's praying.
And we just see basically one white or pink leg and one black leg. And this is pure black, like once again, a void.
Yeah.
Actually, the black leg looks a little longer than the white leg too, which is interesting.
Yeah, that is.
And sort of looking and pointing at him and discussing this are Cosmos and Damien. And then to the right of this, although in the same image, which is a very sort of, you know, medieval, I believe, trope, you have what is presumably an earlier part of the story, because in a coffin, or like a pinkish, presumably wooden box in a mountainous landscape, is a purely black figure with curly, what is that? Seems to be the outline of curly hair.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And this is, it's giving me Kara Walker.
Yes.
It's giving me sort of 19th century, what are they called? Like those shadow portraits.
It's the silhouette portraits.
Yeah, the silhouette portraits that are often talked about in sort of histories of
So interesting black that you art. Say Kara Walker, because for anyone who doesn't know, like she is a black artist who does silhouette cutout portraits of black figures. And you often, well, black and white figures, you know, in narrative with one another, but you can often tell who are the black figures, partially because of the way that she delineates the hair and the features. And so it's really interesting that that is obvious in this piece.
And, you know, there's this black figure, pure black, once again, void. Although now that I look a little closely, you can kind of see eyes, kind of arms. And you see two figures. Is it Cosmos and Damien again? Yes, judging by the clothes. Holding now this black leg. So moving from right to left, you have the black body. Okay, and he has the white leg attached. And this is the most, of all the ones we've seen so far, this white leg is not doing good.
It is like, it's unhappy. Swollen. It is gross.
It's got bloody lesions on it.
Blech.
And it's so stark against that absolute black, this like white leg that's now fully attached. And then in the center, they're sort of carrying the black leg, which now sort of looks like a mannequin leg over. This one is so interesting to me. And you know what it almost makes me think of? It's almost, if you didn't know what the story was, it would look like this man has had his leg skinned. Because the black man. Because the color of his leg is like pink and flesh and blood, not just sort of an attached white leg. It really drives home for me one of the things that as a 21st century viewer is one of the more uncomfortable parts of the story, which is giving the black man the diseased leg, even if he's dead, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, in that excerpt that I read from The Golden Legend by Jacobus de Voragine, that said it just laid next to him in the tomb, but this is showing it fully attached again to that man's body. And I think it's interesting that in this image, when they're handing over the black leg, I mean, the black leg, because they're portraying it in this deep, voidish black, it doesn't look healthy. You know what I mean?
You're right. Whereas, it looks necrified.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the black leg...
Cindered, like
ash. Like burnt. Yeah. Whereas in the first image that I showed you, like that looked like a healthy, like actually
yeah.
black person's leg. You know what I mean? Whereas this is something altogether different.
Yeah, there's a different representational means going on.
Yes.
Right? That like, and maybe that has to do with the first painting we looked at is so much later. It's in a different region.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
and
there
this
are lots
is like
of,
so, yeah, yeah. But it's nevertheless, it's a stylistic difference, but it's very
there are lots of variables. One. But yeah. I think it's important to think about that, how the black body is portrayed. And move on to the next one. And this is by the artist Senna di Pietro, and it's from 1444. So once again, 15th century.
So sort of around the Fra Angelico one. Okay, and this one we have Cosmos and Damien down in the tomb with what for the first time to me looks like a black man. You know, like it's more, he's got sort of a dark brown skin color rather than that absolute black void. He has eyes, you can kind of see a mustache or maybe lips. He feels more like a person, at least to me, than in you know, the other representation. There's no white body and they're about to detach his leg, which is fascinating. It makes it an inversion, but I mean visually, like an inversion of the Fra Angelico one, where there's the white body in the bed.
Yeah.
This time
and
it's
they
the
are
black
getting
body.
And it's showing them, you know, we said that some of them don't show them actually touching the body, actually performing the surgery. This shows Cosmos and Damien getting like literally down and dirty with a corpse. You know what I mean? Like performing the work, even though they are just, you know, saints who have died who are coming in a dream, like it still feels very physical and feels very, you know, bodily and surgical. And they're very much part of the process. But yeah, it's definitely the first one that we see like an actual black body, a full black body. And then the last one I want to look at is this one. And this is from somewhere between 1460 and 1480. And it's from the school of Castile and Leon. So we don't know the exact artist, but...
So this one's fascinating because it takes that visual logic of the twins who are sort of same, same, but different and applies it to the black and white bodies.
Yes,
almost. So in this one, you have Cosmos and Damien standing sort of in the background. There's this white body and they seem to be taking his pulse in the sort of foreground, bang in the center. The black leg
they're
is
taking
now,
the pulse, though, in like a very religious kind of gesture. You know what I mean? It
well,
is.
Also, it reminds me of the like, is he, you know... limp wrist, like
it's very,
like, everyone's very limp wristed.
It's very limp wrist, yeah.
And this figure in the center has this, the surgery's already happened. There's a black leg attached.
There's
this
actual one's, blood.
Yeah, I was gonna say this one of all of them so far is the most like gives the surgery the most, you know, just in the sense of there's this bloody line around it and then drops of blood that are staining the bed beneath. And then cast off below him, almost like a shadow self, is a black man, and even more than the last one we looked at. Oh my God, you see he has a manacle around his ankle? Or
no.
bracelet,
but
to me it reads manacle,
it
and maybe
reads,
that's...
And it's been taken off of the leg that's been put onto the white man, which reads servitude, slavery, etc.
And yeah, they're quite similar looking, except for that the man on the floor is brown, has a brown skin color, and the man in the bed is white. And the one on the floor is very, it's a bit disturbing. Like he's very like, in this case, I guess he's been brought out the tomb, brought here and sort of just dumped on the floor.
Yeah.
His leg is now a stub. You know, it's
he's
been removed. It hasn't, nothing's been replaced. The white leg has disappeared.
Yeah, we don't know where that is.
We don't know where that is. And it's like very like a bloody, you see the blood where the amputation was. He's wearing ragged clothes, which if he only just died, you know, the story says he only just died that day, right? So how the clothes already ragged?
So he must have been, exactly. He must have been of a lower caste or socioeconomic situation, but the manacle around his ankle points to servitude.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, look, I don't
know
enough about the visual culture to say what that is, but to me, definitely as a 21st century viewer, that's what
I find it interesting, the idea of twinning in this image, because you've got Cosmos and Damien at the front, you know, wearing very similar outfits, but inverted, similar hats, but one's red, one's black. And then you've got the two patients, I guess, or the patient and then
the
spare parts, the donor. Yeah, exactly. And they are symmetrical to one another in the way that their legs are splayed, in the way that their necks are pointing. And you've got this red, as you said, kind of ragged outfit on the black body. And you've got this red blanket over the kind of lusciously laid down white body. So you even have the colors are mirroring them as well as bodies
and
connecting them.
And I get that the point of the miracle is sort of merging, you know, a union in some way and like seeing no ill in the union and that's the center of the composition here. But it's impossible to ignore what the cost of that is in this picture. And
And it's impossible to ignore that the white leg has disappeared. And in this one, the white leg is not on the black body. No. So he has no longer a whole body, which, as we know, was important for burial and for
resurrection, right? Yeah. For Judgment Day, the idea that the in sort of Christian traditions that the body needs to be whole.
Exactly.
To can I ask a question that might take us in a different direction?
Sure, yeah.
Which is, maybe it's because this body is the most naturalistically depicted of all of the ones we've seen so far. I mean, it still isn't realist, but yes, you know, it's like, it's like more sensitively depicted. The black man, even though he's sort of discarded on the floor, but you can see his expression.
Yes. Yeah. His lips are downturned. You can see kind of like hollowed cheeks. Yeah. You can see like furrowed brow.
And once again, that's another feature of the mirroring, right? It makes you see him as a subject.
Yes.
Even though he's sort of on the floor. And I don't know if it's just because we've been talking about Kara Walker or because of the manacled foot, but especially because of the affective charge of this image, at least to me as a contemporary, what it does, it makes me think, I mean, of what little I know about the very fucked up history of black people and surgery and, or, you know, I'm thinking of Sims and gynecology.
Absolutely.
But I'm sure you have things to say about this, and I want to know, because do you know what I mean? You know, this body, the different treatments of the body, and you said, right, that these figures are associated with surgery to this day.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
That parallel is just so interesting to me.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to. So now we've gone through all the images that like I wanted to talk about. I mean, there are so many more with Cosmas and Damien, but I think the ones that we've gone through kind of show very different approaches to especially the black body. But I wanted to talk about the idea of race and like outward representation, skin deep identity, and facial transplants, which I know I talk about facial transplants a lot. I just think they're fascinating. Yeah, so very much more recent history of surgery and race. But in 2019, there was the first facial transplant. So once again, you know, we're looking at transplants here, like even though we haven't necessarily been talking about them that way, like it is transplanting one body part onto another person's body. The first transplant of a face onto a Black American face. And the interviews with that patient, who's named Robert Chelsea, have been really interesting for thinking about skin color is important in identity. I mean, basically, that's what it is. And Robert Chelsea was the first Black American, first African American to receive a facial transplant. And in all of his interviews, he talks about how he and his surgeons, you know, because his Black identity was super important to him and his darker skin tone was super important to him, but how he devised this like 1 to 18 scale of skin darkness.
Mm.
And he was willing to take anywhere between an 8 and a 16.
Right.
And, you know, he had been waiting for so long to get a face transplant. You know, he'd been in this horrible car accident. And yet that was so important to him that he was willing to wait longer to get a match to him.
And we've actually talked in the last episode about, well, we talked about Deleuze and we talked about faciality a bit. But the sense that, like, that the face is such a marker of your identity. I mean, that makes perfect sense to me.
Absolutely.
And also that, did you say he's American? Did you say?
He was American, yeah. Or he is American.
Especially in contemporary America, how much your Black identity is a part of who you are.
Absolutely. And I think he's a really important figure because he has become an advocate for having more Black organ donors because the face is classed as an organ, right? And
I didn't know that.
Well, yeah. So it's classed, like if you're donating, you can, if you're an organ donor, you can donate your face. He talks a lot about how, you know, historically, Black Americans especially are super distrustful of surgical and medical systems.
And that goes back to the Sims.
Exactly. And you mentioned Sims. Do you want to mention who Sims was?
Yes. I don't remember his full name.
But Marion? James Marion?
That could, you know more than I do, definitely.
James. Yeah.
James. James Marion Sims. He was a 19th century, he's considered the father of gynecology. I said that with an eye roll, but. You know,
I feel like any title that is father of blank and it's like a white man from the 19th century is immediately eye roll inducing.
Any father of anything is so often like self-titled. Anyway, sidebar. So Sims is known for being quote unquote the father of gynecology. And, you know, I think it's this idea that like a lot of the techniques he developed or something were like super important to like the modern field or something. I think he developed the first speculum.
Gross.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
But how he gained this knowledge was essentially through torture, right?
Yeah.
He did incredibly painful, invasive gynecological operations on, I know of three, I don't know how many they were, but three Black slaves. He did these invasive, painful operations on Black slave women who couldn't concept. I mean, who are property? And yeah. there's a whole bunch of stuff that I remember reading at some point about how, like, the owners would sign, like, that Sims has to pay if there's damage to that. You know, it's like,
well, because
I have to say, of a lot of this, I read a lot of, like, gruesome and horrifying stuff. And this is one of the things that is the most uncomfortable and awful for me.
It really is. To read about. I mean, it's one of the worst. I mean, and history of medicine is pretty bad, but it is one of the worst, most egregious forms of
abuse, torture. Did I mention yeah. explicitly that it was without anesthesia? Because that's the whole bit.
Anesthesia.
That's the whole mm-hmm. bit that he was doing these operations without anesthesia. And it plays into these 19th century ideas that black women don't feel, continuing yes. ideas that black yes. women don't feel pain or don't, like white women do. And that's literally, I mean, as the title of Father of Gynecology says, that is built into yeah. the history of that medical field.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not the only medical field.
No,
that's the case.
So related to that, like continuing this idea that black bodies are there for, you know, white physicians to experiment on, which we literally see in these images of Cosmos and Damien. Like they are, okay, yeah. maybe they weren't white like in their lifetime. Maybe they were, you know, from Syria or Turkey. But it, like the iconography of it is that it is white surgeons using black bodies.
Yeah, or just even visually, like, there's yeah, a white visually, body with visually, a black leg exactly. surgically attached to it.
But anyway, that, you know, the Sims discourse relates to the other super well-known example of this, which is the Tuskegee syphilis experiments, which is when, you know, in Tuskegee, Alabama, you know, these physicians, even after penicillin had been invented and there was a treatment for syphilis, they wanted to see how it ran out in the body over years and years. So they, without letting these black individuals know, they continued to not treat them to keep them in the study just to see how syphilis worked.
Well, I don't know if it's the twin talk also, but it's also reminding me of the Nazis' experimentation on Jews and other minorities
and, you know,
during the Holocaust.
This is after Americans were thinking better than thou, you know, like we beat the Nazis, we're so much better than them, we don't believe in eugenics, or we're, you know, like not anti-Semitic. Yeah, well, you're doing the same things just on a different population of people.
Yeah. There's definitely a complication in this idea of him looking down and seeing no ill.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, going back to the original
original quote.
And it's this idea that, like, does by seeing no ill mean that he doesn't see a different race?
Yeah, I don't see color. Like, is that the idea?
What you're saying? Is that like...
Well, evidently not, because it's the mystery of the black... Or the mystery. Nancy Drew. The miracle of the black leg. And also that it's referred to, you know, whoever wrote this refers to Moor and
Jacobus?
Ethiopian. Sorry, Jacobus.
Jacobus? So it's obviously important.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Like just because he doesn't see no ill doesn't mean he doesn't see race.
Yeah.
At least that's the way that we're seeing it. Yeah, so like questions of slavery and this idea of spare parts or like agency, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's that direct, at least in my head and looking at this picture, like that direct mental connection I'm making between the slaves that Sims operated on and this manacled black body.
This manacled black body. I think it's really interesting to think about that question about agency, slavery, and body parts. And this amazing book that I just finished, I've been meaning to read it for ages, by Emily Cock, which is about rhinoplasty, which we talked about in the Andy Warhol episode, but is the reconstruction of the nose job, whatever, in early modern Britain. So she talks about this idea that there were rumors going around that kind of sullied the reputation of the rhinoplasty, meaning... So the rhinoplasty was actually an autograft, meaning that you took skin from your own body. And a lot of the anxieties around race and that body work, which is the phrase that Cock uses, also I can see at work in these images of Cosmos and Damien, where the rhinoplasty was actually an autograft, which means that you take the skin from your own body to reconstruct your nose. That could be from like the inside of your arm, inner thigh, whatever. But there were all these rumors swirling around that it was actually an allograft, which means that you take the flesh or skin, depending on the phrase used, and that makes a big difference, actually, from another person.
And people freaked out about that?
People freaked out about that. And there was this idea like, oh, does that mean that you're buying flesh from someone else? Or does that mean that you're getting flesh from an enslaved person?
Which also is sort of reminding me of Shylock.
From the Merchant of Venice.
And like
absolutely.
One of the most famous like racialized.
Yeah. Asking for a pound of flesh in terms of payment. Yeah. There's this strange, like, how do you equate flesh with remuneration? You know what I mean? Like, is there a way to put a price on body parts?
Yeah.
Anyway, so there was this, there were these rumors going around that you could actually... you know, get a nose from a slave, which was, in the 16th century, more often than not actually Slavic peoples in Italy. So it's interesting, you know, that this is a black body, but...
Although Otella does point out there were black slaves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely there like were. But, like, a lot of the rumors and the anxieties around having an enslaved person's nose actually related to a paler piece of skin going onto a darker body.
Well, it sort of reminds me of our discussion in previous episodes also about the Irish nose.
Yeah.
No? And, like, I mean, there's lots of different kinds of constructions of race. It's not just... blackness. We just happen to be focusing on
absolutely. In this particular. So a lot of the anxieties were around like a darker skinned European man getting a Slavic enslaved person's nose. And that played on ideas of, you know, not only racial difference, but also, you know, the ideas around who would get the pox. So sexually transmitted diseases, right. Which would be the darker skinned person who would lose their nose and have to get a new one.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there's this great image from actually the 18th century of this man in...
who has a dark skin and a white nose, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to see kind of the inversion. Yes, it's a couple centuries later. The inversion, but the same kind of like playing on this difference of skin type between white and black. Mm-hmm. And like the anxieties around getting a different colored body part.
Yeah.
Which, as we can see with the case of Robert Chelsea, like is still a concern because it's about your identity. And it's about...
and about your face, which is sort of the seat of your...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And and as you mentioned, that basically has a direct connection sort of back to the present and to like the current practices of surgery.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I'm super interested in terms of histories of surgery is how surgeons write their own histories. So there's this amazing article by a historian and surgeon named Thomas Schlick called How Gods and Saints Became Transplant Surgeons. So the saints...
That's such a great
title. I know.
Title.
And so he's talking about... the saints that he's talking about are Cosmas and Damien, right? And so he decries, quote, why intelligent and educated people, such as transplant surgeons, engage in producing a sort of history that for many historians looks little short of absurd.
Well, that I am familiar with. Because you know how many physicists love to write, quote unquote, histories of physics? And it's just stay in your lane.
That's what I mean. Like, and so they... I mean, it's probably similar for physicists, but transplant surgeons will use really kind of irrelevant or mythological, or they didn't, who knows if they actually existed in real life, figures like Cosmas and Damien to like beef up biographies of 19th or 20th century surgeons. Mm. Like they'll tie Cosmas and Damien to modern medical brothers like John and William Hunter from 18th century Scotland or the Mayo brothers from like 19th century America.
Yeah.
And so I read a couple of articles of, you know, they're always like 2 pages long. Not that that's a problem. I love brevity. But articles by present-day physicians like talking about Cosmas and Damien, and you'll love this. One of them that I read from 2014 was submitted 11th of August, accepted 13th of August.
And published
9th of September. It also claimed that Adam's rib to become Eve was the first successful transplant. And it's just like...
where do you begin?
Really? None of these things are real history, first of all.
Yeah.
And so these figures like Cosmas and Damien just serve as these kind of like, I don't know, like false equivalencies, but like they're heroes of the field, but...
it's almost like they're doing what we're doing, but with none of the self-awareness. And I don't say that to pat ourselves on the back, but we're like... we're explicitly talking about this from this perspective and looking at these images and what do they bring up instead of being like, you can actually directly see the origins and of modern surgery in these pictures of like miraculous occurrences.
And there is
As if pictures tell the truth also.
Exactly. No, exactly. Because they don't. And there's so little self-awareness in the use of figures like Cosmas and Damien, but they pop up everywhere. You know, it's like, okay, so these Nobel Prize winners are a modern Cosmas and Damien. These brothers are basically like... in the lineage of them.
Yeah.
So it's just a really interesting like use of these figures that is really kind of ahistorical.
When I mentioned that, you know, images don't tell the truth. And I think it's also really important that when we look at these historical images in which we see blackness, in which we see whiteness, and we see the depiction of them, that this also isn't just like, I mean, this is very obvious if you're an art historian, but maybe not to everyone. Like, this isn't God's truth, no pun intended, that like, even what we're seeing, even if this man, the white man, accepted the black leg, does that tell us anything about race relations in, you know, 15th century Spain or Italy? Like, not really, you know?
Yeah, like and does the writing of a religious myth tell us anything about surgery in 15th century Italy or Spain? Like, it really doesn't.
But it can evoke things for us, right? And it can bring things up. And I do think it's fascinating, you know, to notice things like the manacle, to think about, I mean, you know, to think about the long history of Africans in Europe, blackness in Europe, no matter how that's been sort of variously represented, or no matter what it's quote unquote essentially meant.
Thank you for listening to the fifth episode of our podcast, Drawing Blood. We'd like to thank the Experimental Humanities Collaborative Network for funding this podcast in its initial stages. And we'd love to thank C.S. Merkling for his wonderful audio editing skills. Please do give us a rating on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, and we will bring you the sixth episode soon. Bye!